Thank you very much, Tony. What we're going to try to do, we're going to turn to the other folks in the panel, but open up a phone line with Tony so that he can at least hear what they're saying and we can transmit questions since we can't get a direct line to him at the moment. So what we'll do, we'll move down this panel here. First, Patrick Markham, who is at the National Security Council, will provide sort of the U.S. official perspective on aid and assistance. And then Key Liu is also in the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. He will not speak, but he can answer questions and comment and pose some questions. But Chris Beyrer, who is an epidemiologist with a lot of experience in Burma, will speak last from his experience on some of the epidemic potential in the South. We need to turn that down. Okay. Okay, with that, let me turn then to Patrick to start in our panel discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. I appreciate being here, particularly appreciate CSIS hosting an event to bring light to an important issue and one that's of great concern to us all. I'd particularly also like to thank, you know, WFP, you know, the UN, and all the NGOs that are on the ground or trying to get on the ground. I think what often gets overlooked when events like this happen are people put their lives on the line to go into places that are very dangerous in order to provide humanitarian assistance. And so for those people that are on the ground, whether they're with the U.S. government or other international organizations, you know, we want to make sure that we note some of their heroic work and we appreciate their efforts. I also want to thank the media for being here because we appreciate the light that you bring to this and that there is an opportunity to bring attention to the need for help in Burma, and we have some great people here that can speak to the details of that kind of help that can be provided. I'd just ask for a little bit of patience, and whether it's the Q&A section or even with our own remarks, many of us are working on short sleep, and so please ask for clarification if something sounds inconsistent with what you've heard before, or if we're not particularly clear with an answer. We'll do our best to answer to the best of our ability to certain questions. But so appreciate your patience with that. Lastly, there are numerous angles to look at this event, but I think everything is ultimately pretty simple. There is a large-scale natural disaster that hit Burma, and the United States has a strong desire to assist and to help the people of Burma, and I think that's shared by the whole international community. We are hopeful that we will be able to go and help the people of Burma, and we are working towards that end. I can't say it much more simply than that. And with that, I probably would like to turn over to Key, who can provide a lot of the details. Again, these are the experts. These are people who know what it's like on the ground, who have been in Burma before, they are in Burma now, or have answered to numerous natural disasters around the world and provided life-saving assistance. So I'll just turn it over to Key.
Thanks. I will echo Patrick's comments and say that we are committed, we're prepared, and we continue to provide immediate life-saving assistance. Thus far, the U.S. government has committed $3.25 million in this effort. The initial $250,000 was released to the embassy. That went to front-load activities for some of our U.N. colleagues, including WFP, UNHCR, and UNICEF. We've also made a commitment for an additional $1 million of that 3.25 to the American Red Cross. That $1 million contribution will go towards the purchase, procurement, and distribution of non-food items, plastic sheeting, jerry cans, blankets, types of materials that we understand that in the immediate stages here need to be distributed and received by the impacted communities. The rest of the 3.25, of which $2 million, will go towards NGO partners who are currently operational in-country. We are in discussions with them. We'll be prepared to be able to release the details of that most likely at the end of the day, if not over the weekend. The point we want to stress here is that the 3.25 that has been released is an initial contribution. I think you've heard from WP, you've heard from the reports here. The issue at hand is access. Can we get the relief workers who are currently on the ground now to have freedom of mobility to get out to the impacted areas in order to be able to distribute the existing supplies? Can we get additional international staff from all of the humanitarian community to be able to come in to provide additional assistance? What we know is that though what is existing in country and of our operational partners there are doing an incredible job, that said, given the size and the scope of this disaster, much more needs to be done. We urge the authorities to be able to allow relief flights to come in. We urge the authorities to be able to allow relief workers and NGO and UN colleagues to be able to stand up their operations. And I will end by saying that the USAID's Office for Disaster Assistance has stood up a 10-person DART team that's pre-positioned in Bangkok at this point. They are working closely with the Interagency Standing Committee in terms of assessing and coordinating activities. Again, operating from a remote stance creates difficulties. We very much agree with what Tony said. We understand that the size and the scope of this disaster does not require, let's say, an assessment in order to determine to trigger additional assistance. But what is needed is to be able to determine what the basic infrastructure is available in order so that relief commodities, if they're able to come in, are not sitting at the tarmacs because there's not enough forklift capacity to move them around. We need to assess to make sure that there are warehouses in order to be able to put the supplies in. We need to make sure that the existing partners have access to helicopters and other heavy lift to be able to move commodities into the impacted areas. And that is something that the DART, or let's say the UNDEC team and other coordinating entities do an incredible job of, to make sure that these sorts of basic infrastructure are mapped, are implemented, and carried out in order to allow the community as a whole to be able to move life-saving assistance. At this point in time, unfortunately, our 10-person DART has not received permission by the authorities to enter. We continue to press that our assistance is not contingent upon entry of the DART. However, we would hope that the DART and other international experts are able to do so. It greatly facilitates and expedites the delivery assistance. So let me stop there.
Thanks very much. And I'd like to echo just at the start that it's very good to hear people highlighting the most fundamental issue here, which is access and the intransigence of this junta. And the reason I say that is because that has been true for some 15 years now, that access has been a fundamental issue with responding to the public health problems that this country has been facing and that the people of Burma have been facing before Cyclone Narcus. I want to just say at the start that this obviously was an enormous cataclysmic storm. The scale of it is very great, and the scale of the suffering, I think, is going to unfold when access improves and we begin to see really how many people have been lost and how many people have been displaced. But that said, this was a cyclone that also affected a population that had a number of pre-existing problems, and many of those were the outcome to some degree of military misrule. We have been, for a long time, dealing with the reality, those of us who have been involved in health and human rights in this country, that the regime does not fundamentally have the interests of its people as its primary concern, and I think that that has been underscored by the insistence on going forward with this referendum tomorrow in the context of this enormous cyclone. And so I'd like to just also appreciate Ban Ki-moon's request to delay the referendum. But nevertheless, at last we've heard, the junta does appear to be going forward. What am I talking about when I say these pre-existing problems? Well, there are several. Before I get into them, I just want to highlight what I think is going to be the first or the next wave of real problems. We are very likely to see a beginning of epidemic diseases, and particularly waterborne infectious diseases, which are very likely to be the next wave of loss of life. There is a mixing of drinking water, wastewater. There are a number of flooded wells. And as one of the sort of pre-existing problems of this region of Burma, and indeed of Rangoon itself, is that there have been a number of cholera outbreaks in the last several years. So cholera is endemic in this area. We know that already. And there have certainly been some large cholera epidemics, which were, again, suppressed by the junta and where access was a real problem. We also expect that there will be E. coli, enterotoxigenic E. coli, which is a major cause of diarrheal disease. disease and dehydration. Both E. coli and cholera principally kill people through dehydration. The case fatality rates for these diseases, if they're appropriately managed, are actually quite low. The most recent cholera outbreak in Bangladesh, the case fatality rates are under 1%. But if they're not appropriately managed and dehydration is not appropriately managed, the case fatality rates can be as high as 20%. That's what we saw in the initial phases in Goma in the DRC. And unfortunately, if the limitations on access continue the way they are, I think that's a reasonable expectation for what is likely to happen in this delta. A second issue, you already heard from Tony Banbury that people are starting to congregate in large groups. That it is a recurring problem when this happens in disasters that you have outbreaks of childhood measles. Immunization coverage rates are relatively low in some of these areas. We don't have great data on coverage, but there is an expectation that measles will be an outbreak. And I should say, again, that measles is a disease with a relatively low case fatality rate in healthy children. But in children with chronic malnutrition and protein calorie malnutrition, the case fatality rates are much higher. Two very basic issues there. One is that the best estimates for childhood malnutrition in this country are something that close to a third of Burma's children under age five were chronically malnourished last fall. So before this occurrence. So we are talking about a population that already has marginal food issues. The second issue to be clear about is, of course, everybody here, I think, is aware of the uprising last fall, what's been called the Saffron Revolution. But that began as an uprising initially over the spike in energy costs when the junta changed its policies on price supports. That led to a rise in food costs. It led to a rise in energy costs. And so there was food insecurity before August of 2007. It increased after August of 2007, and there is no reason to think, unfortunately, that it won't increase further, both in the acute phase of this disaster, but also because 60% of Burma's rice-growing capacity was in this delta. This storm has not just flooded that delta, it has altered the geography as far as we can see from satellite maps, and whole areas of farmland are really under open water. So I think I would summarize by saying from this aspect of this crisis that it is not just an acute humanitarian disaster. It is going to have long-term consequences. And the international response, which we hope, of course, gets moving quickly and is allowed access, is going to have to be sustained. This is a population that already had pre-existing health problems. It also, of course, has also had pre-existing problems with health infrastructure, and the health infrastructure of Burma has been eroded by disinvestment in healthcare for more than a decade. And I would just like to say that while it's true, and there have been critics who have said that one of the principal reasons why the healthcare infrastructure has eroded in Burma is because of sanctions, that in fact, this is one of the countries in the world with the lowest level of public expenditures in health coming from the government. That is why in 2000, when WHO did its Millennium Assessment of Healthcare Systems, Burma came in second to last. The only country outperforming it, doing worse, was Sierra Leone, which did not have a government at the time. And that extraordinarily low level of investment in health infrastructure is also going to affect this response. There simply aren't going to be the clinics, physicians, care providers out there, particularly in remote rural areas, to treat people with acute injuries. It's true that in these kinds of flood disasters, there are fewer of those than, say, earthquake-type disasters, but nevertheless, there are a number of those. And as we go from the acute phase now coming on a week almost since this cyclone, more and more of those injured are not getting access to health care. I want to just say one or two other things. One is that, of course, the fundamental political goal of this junta has been this referendum on the Constitution. That is due to be set tomorrow. They have given a two-week delay for some of the more affected townships and areas. That referendum and the sort of push intimidation of people to vote yes on this new constitution, I just heard as of yesterday that there were still soldiers and USDA members pressuring people in Karen and Shan states to vote yes on this referendum. So that, I think, is just a very poor use of military capacity in the midst of this cyclone. Finally, I want to say the Burmese people always outperform their government. It's an amazingly impressive thing. And we have some reports just this morning from some of the ethnic groups of teams that are being fielded that I think are really meeting this responsibility to protect, that are bypassing the junta. Just to give you an example, I'm not going to name the ethnic group or the organization, but one of them has fielded 8 teams now in Rangoon in the Irrawaddy Delta, 5 people on each team. They've been trained in emergency response. They are trying to adapt to the local conditions on the ground and provide what appears to be necessary. I just asked them, what do you need most? What's the thing that would help the most right now? And their response, which was really shocking to me, I think, was money. The issue is that there are food and relief supplies and medicines to some degree available, and people are being charged for them. And so you have people who really have nothing, including literally no clothes, who are being asked to pay for food and water and clothing. These relief teams could do more if they simply had money to help people pay for them. I think that really is not meeting humanitarian standard of response. But nevertheless, the people of Burma really are trying, and I think they deserve all of our support. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chris, and thanks to the rest. Tony, I understand you can hear us through the phone. So what we're going to do is we're going to turn up the sound out here and give you an opportunity to make some comments based on this or questions, if you'd like, if you have any.
Yeah, I'll have to go. I can.
Let me get any comments. I'm sorry. I did hear what Keith said. I didn't really get to hear much of what Patrick said. I'm sorry about that. But I think for the sound of it, we all have the same objective, the same concern, and the same fervent hope that the VMAR and the Burmese authorities are going to change their stance and let professional aid workers in, because the situation is obviously desperate. We're going to be doing everything we can. I don't have that much to add to what I said before and what the other panelists have already mentioned. Okay. And I'm afraid to have to dash, I think, because I can't hear what you're saying, and there's a lot going on here still. So if you'll allow me, I'd like to thank you very much again for the opportunity and really appreciate all the support from the U.S. government and USAID, of course, as well, and the NGOs, the aid agencies there. Really, it's great knowing you're there, and your efforts are making a difference, too, in one way or the other. Thanks. So thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony. It's understandable. Certainly, you go off and do your job. Let me just ask a couple questions, maybe of my NSC counterparts. What normally in these situations regarding Burma, there is obviously you need to get in and have some influence on the regime, and China is usually mentioned as one of those who can get in and do this. First of all, what do we know? What are we saying to China? What do we know about what they're doing? And secondly, are we, as a U.S. government, engaging the regime or seeking to reach out in some extraordinary way, given the extraordinary nature of this situation, despite our reluctance to do so for other reasons?
I'll just answer briefly. Our messages to the international community, as our communications with the government of Burma, are all the same, and the same as my opening remarks. We have a lot of experience with helping in international disasters, and I speak for my colleague Key that we're very good at it, and we'd like to help. We've communicated this to the Chinese. We've communicated this to a number of embassies around the world. We have had numerous contacts on numerous levels, all with the same message, and the same message that you hear every day. So it's pretty simple. It's usually nuanced in a different way to trying to adapt to local cultures and the way that diplomats work. We're a functional bureau at the NSC, so please don't misperceive me as a diplomat. Mm-hmm. But the message is always the same. We're ready to help. We have the capability to help and the expertise, and we're just really trying to have everybody else that we reach out to send that same message to the Burmese if they have different channels than us.
Let me add to that. The Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, or OFDA, is the lead office within the U.S. government providing humanitarian assistance globally in response to international disasters. The assistance we provide is needs-based. We have what we call notwithstanding authority that allows us to be able to provide on behalf of the American people and the U.S. government humanitarian assistance regardless of whether a country has relations or unfriendly relations with us. So you see recently whether it's responses to the BAM earthquake in Iran, assistance to Venezuela, assistance to Cuba, you know, what we try to do is to be able to bring in the disaster experts who can help and who can provide the most immediate life-saving activities. And again, our message is clear to the authorities as we provide assistance globally elsewhere. This is humanitarian assistance. This is needs-based. If you allow our teams to be able to come in and allow us to be able to work with the international community as a whole, we will be able to make a difference. The longer that we sit on the sidelines, the longer that that the relief commodities are not able to enter the country, the longer that the teams that are currently in the country are not allowed access, people are dying, and it's approaching a week.
Let me leave it open. We have microphones for people who want to ask questions, so please. Ma'am in the back.
Thanks. Michelle Kellerman with National Public Radio. I wondered if you can look back, and you mentioned a few previous examples of working with difficult governments, if there's anything ever been this bad, this long, this difficult? And secondly, at what point does the responsibility to protect kick in? I mean, there's 1.5 million people in need of help.
Take on the first part, and then maybe have Patrick discuss the second portion. You know, sometimes a lack of a response or a lack of requests on the part of an impacted country is not always a bad sign. We always say that the front line in terms of response and the responsibility, you know, is with the national authorities. And as we saw in the context of Bangladesh last year when the initial floods, there was no request forthcoming from the international community. That wasn't because that the impact of the floods were not dramatic on the beneficiaries, but it's because the government of Bangladesh had the capacity to respond. So, again, it's tough to be able to say and compare a lack of a response or a lack of requests in this scenario. What we are concerned with here is that there is a long track record with regard to Burma where there has been denial of services and access to vulnerable population. And that raises concerns for us. What we hear in terms of anecdotal information from our partners, and as Chris pointed here, this is a very vulnerable population. And a shock of this magnitude is going to take people right off the cliff. And that's the concern that we have. We, again, would hope that there could be reversals in terms of access. But, again, we continue to be prepared and committed to do what we can.
Just to touch on the second part of that question, we believe that the UN has, and as I stated earlier, has an important role to play in this, and we're interested in actions that will lead or UN actions and statements that will lead to a response within Burma. I think that there's always a danger of getting caught into legalisms and discussions once things get – issues like that get brought into the UN. It'll take up time as opposed to other avenues that might take action. But we support the UN in their efforts and working on this, and we want – whatever takes place there, we want to make sure that it's going to lead to a result that will help humanitarian access in Burma.
Introduce yourself.
Tom Malinowski with Human Rights Watch. Is this on? My question is, are all the people who you need to reach in the Delta today reachable by land from Rangoon? In other words, if you could get the aid workers that you need and the supplies you need into the airport, would that be sufficient to get to all the affected communities? Or are there people who can only be reached using the naval and air assets that militaries with assets in the region have offered and are standing by to provide?
Yeah. The preliminary reports that are coming back from partners who have had access are reporting damage of up to 95% in certain areas. 65% of a large portion of this is still underwater. That said, I think given the fact that we are, again, approaching a week in order for us to be able to get supplies out immediately to reach all the vulnerable populations, it is going to require heavy lift capacity. And what we know in terms of what is currently available with regard to the authorities in terms of numbers of helos to be able to move this, it's not adequate. And it's not as if there's a large, robust commercial capacity either. So what we're looking at here is obviously getting in supplies, but we have to build the infrastructure to distribute it, and we absolutely do need at this point in time, from what we're hearing, the ability to for heavy lift capacity to be able to move commodities from ports, from the airports out to the outlying areas.
Jacob Kurtzer, Refugees International. I'm wondering, has the administration made a specific request from the Congress to add to the supplemental spending bill that will be in the works in the next few weeks to create a special fund along the lines of the tsunami supplemental or the Pakistan supplemental in the past to allow for a robust humanitarian assistance program if and when access is allowed, and also to create a long-term humanitarian assistance program to deal with the long-term global health ramifications?
Thank you very much. That's a good question. Unfortunately, I'm not from the budget part of the NSC, and so I'm not aware of any discussions that have taken place. That's not to say that they haven't. It's just that's not part of my activities in the NSC. It's not part of my portfolio. So I'm not. I couldn't answer that question. I apologize.
Okay, right next to you, right there.
On a scale of this magnitude, in terms of responding in the acute phase, the Office for Disaster Assistance, again, we do have a fund available that's held in reserve exactly for these sorts of situations. For example, with regard to the tsunami, I think we were able to release almost $80 million within weeks of this. That said, one of the authorities that I had noted for you in terms of our notwithstanding authority, we do have borrowing authority, which allows us in an instant that is on scale of this, if we do not have the necessary resources on hand, we can reach out to some of our other federal offices to be able to borrow additional funding so that the focus is in terms of getting assistance out the door. But right now, the issue is really not money. We do have the resources available for the short emergency phase. The problem is how do we program it in a way that guarantees us with some degree of assurance that it will reach the impacted beneficiaries. And you see here discussions in terms of WFP flights. You know, we saw an opening here in terms of the agreement for the four flights. Again, we're disappointed that what's happening with these two flights, and we hope that it's reversed. And we hope that the trend here in terms of further access and further flights will be approved on a grander scale, and not just limited to WFP, but really to the international community as a whole.
Thank you. Paul Corson from CNN. I hear a little bit of a discrepancy here. You're saying money's not really that much needed, and you're getting reports on the ground that money is needed. It begs the question, on supplies that are already in the area, are they being diverted? Is there enough security that if you get more aid into the region, it's not going to be diverted in some sort of money-making scheme?
Well, I think that is a potential concern. The money that I'm referring to is essentially that, and these are reports from Rangoon and then areas south of Rangoon toward the Delta where these teams are operating, is that in some cases there is food or clothing available. There is, for example, roofing material available, but people have to pay for it. It's not being distributed. In some cases, it is a local military command that's charging. In others, we're not entirely sure who is charging. So the people on the ground need money. I think the issue is that from the international perspective, there are resources, there's planes, there's equipment, there's funding, and that if there were access, the money internationally could be mobilized, and certainly much of it already has been mobilized. So the disconnect, I think, really is on the ground in these areas. And, you know, what you would like to see humanitarian relief assistance be provided for in this kind of a context is, of course, to those most in need, not on the basis of who can pay.
Yeah, just to clarify that, I mean, the point is in the acute phase right now, you have seen donors, international donors, lined up in terms of pledging funds. How do we get those pledged funds and operationalize in a manner where you don't have relief supplies sitting on the tarmac? How do we make sure that the funding that would need to go to groups that already have on-the-ground experience gets to them and is not diverted? That's the key.
I only stand because I couldn't see the folks over here. We'll continue. Please, ma'am.
From PACT, we have on the ground about 400 local staff in the Delta, And we just spoke to our country rep this morning, and he confirmed what you're saying is they need cash. They need cash to give to people so that they can then purchase the materials locally. There still are materials available locally. So the local distribution system is available. What's missing are some of the links, but I think we're going to be able to get some cash down to them very shortly.
Thank you. Ninin Pine. I like your opinion on to what extent does the international community have to wait for an approval from an illegitimate government that is currently ruling Burma in this kind of a crisis? And I ask this because, for me, I guess I'm not going to try to mince words, but this is the most outrageous, unbelievable action that's being taken by this military junta. And I'm asking this question. They are in there. They're not legitimate. To what extent do we have to be waiting for an approval from them?
I'll try and answer that question briefly. I mean, we're working as hard as we can to try and get access into the country to help the people. It is a dire situation. There is no doubt about it. I think the pleas of the international community are resonating. We need to explore diplomatic channels to their full extent, and that's what we're in the process of doing. We are hopeful because there are communications, and we will keep pushing that channel. That's the best I can say. The other issues, we are here to talk about a humanitarian response and to do that to the best of our ability.
I guess I'd also just respond that I think fundamentally in this acute phase, there's this issue of scale. It's just going to be such an enormous scale. So, and I think it's hard to imagine being able to respond to that without, for example, the use of airports and waters and components of the infrastructure of this country that are under military control by the junta. Well, that said, I do think that there already are, as I said, I know that there are already efforts underway, and certainly by the Burmese people and by some of the ethnic groups that have been delivering humanitarian assistance outside of the junta's control. Those are going to continue. I think they're going to expand. It's hard to imagine that they're going to be able to respond to a disaster of this magnitude. In the longer term, they may have more of a role to play. But I think for now you have to say that the junta controls what assets there are, and without their participation, it's going to be very hard to mount a response.
One follow-up. As I noted, the $3.25 million that we have committed, that's not a pledge. That's already most of it, as I said, is already in the hands of partners, and all of it, of that 3.25, will hopefully be in the hands of partners as of today. And we are looking for other partners here who can come forward with programs that, again, here allows us some degree of assurance that the funds made available will reach the impacted beneficiaries. So on the humanitarian front, we're not necessarily, as I said, waiting for a DART team to come in order for funds to be released, in order to put it in the hands of our partners. That's already taking place.
Paul Eckert of Reuters News Agency. People who've worked with North Korea in the last decade with their famine and other things, similar regime characteristics, and those who advocate new batches of food aid for what seems to be another food crisis in North Korea right now, they say assume a large degree of diversion, pilfering, etc. But some will say still flood the zone, because even if it's done crookedly, it gets to people. Is that the philosophy that could or should pertain in the case of this cyclone crisis?
I would say, and this is perhaps more of a personal opinion, I won't speak for any of the other institutions here, that the answer has to be yes. You know, that diversion is an issue. Everybody knows it's going to be an issue. If you look at Transparency International's accounting of this junta, it's one of the most corrupt regimes in the world, unfortunately. But nevertheless, if you look at the level of aid that's getting in there now and what could get in there if there was access, there's just no question that we should make every due diligence and best effort to avoid diversion, but not let that be something that hampers access. I think that would be a terrible mistake.
The concern we have right now is the ability for the existing infrastructure to support a large-scale response. We're already hearing that the limited amount of assistance that is coming there is already piling up the tarmac. So I would agree with you that on a disaster of this scale and magnitude, anything that we can do that will have an impact, we will be looking at the options. That said, what we don't want happening would be to have the food and the essential supplies sit in the airports and not go out to the impacted areas. That's not going to help anyone.
John Knauss from the National Endowment for Democracy. Chris, you mentioned the referendum, and I was wondering how much you think the referendum is playing in with the access issue and how much it's delaying the access, bringing foreign observers in and viewing the process, and whether when the referendum is conducted tomorrow, whether that will open up access afterwards.
It is a consummation devoutly to be wished. I think if certainly, you know, there's always a lot of, junta watching, junta reading, trying to understand what the motivations of these people are. And I think the fact that they have held on to this date for the referendum and are pushing it forward speaks volumes about their priorities, and that they're using military resources to continue to cajole and intimidate, and in some cases provide incentives and ID cards and so forth to people while this crisis is unfolding in other parts of the country also speaks volumes. That said, in some ways, if that is the issue, we've had at least one relief worker that I know of who tried to get a visa in a neighboring country and was told, come back Monday. We think we're going to be able to start, you know, moving people through on Monday after the referendum. Now, it's also true that overseas Burmese, we've had several reports of this, have been going to embassies trying to find out about family members and see if people are okay and do what people normally do. And what they have been told is, don't forget to vote on the referendum, as opposed to, your family's fine or they're not. So it is definitely a fundamental priority for this regime. It's interesting. I don't know how many people have seen, but there just has been an independent poll by a number of independent news agencies looking at about 2,000 people on the response to the referendum. The proportion of people anyway polled who said that they would vote yes is under 10% or so. What's most striking about that poll, I think, is that they asked people, what is your reason for voting? And you'd think that in many cases it would be intimidating. And the great majority of people responded that they wanted to vote because of their sense of civic responsibility, and they were going to vote no. So that suggests that this referendum might look something like 1990, that once again the people of Burma would not do what they're being told and threatened to do, but to vote no on the referendum. If that's the case, who knows, first of all, if those results will be released, if they'll make what they consider the same mistake that they made before, and what impact that will have on whether or not they'll allow humanitarian assistance. I think that those are unknowns.
It's Steve Morrison from CSIS. Can you comment on what's the role and perspective of the Chinese and of the ASEAN member states as we look forward? I mean, right now there's a concentrated focus on access of personnel and material, that trying to enlarge the aperture for folks to enter. That's what I'm hearing, is that may be enlarged and it may offer some around the margins some improvements, but we're still going to have a staggering problem staring at us. As we look forward, what's the state of our dialogue with the Chinese or ASEAN member states on the bigger picture and how to work this?
Liz Fu up here from the NSC, who's more the diplomatic side of things than just simply human. You can do as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just in terms, the Chinese and ASEAN has a very important role to play. We're reaching out to them, as I mentioned before. They have good communications, or as good as communications as we understand with the Burmese, and so we're asking them to intercede, as we're asking for other nations to offer their assistance as well as to let them know that we're willing to help as well. So we're just basically exercising all possible communications to try and get into the country and help. I mean, so we're exercising all diplomatic options, basically.
I would just add quickly that ASEAN. I'm sorry, Liz Fu from the NSC. I would just add very quickly that that ASEAN has come out publicly, issued statements calling for access, and so we're all focused on the same issue, and we very much appreciate that, that they're doing that as an organization and as individual countries. So certainly, you know, hopefully their ties with Burma and China's close relationship will have an influence. But again, everyone is on the same page calling for access.
Back to money. We heard Tony talk a little bit about a UN appeal tomorrow, I believe it was, for more funding. And you were talking about diplomatic relations with China. What about the OPEC countries? And what is underway in terms of talking with them about getting more money as well, since they've got so much cash coming in from oil revenues?
I can't speak for WFP appeals to the OPEC countries. I think that Key can talk to this better than I. At the moment, the issue is about pipelines and about making sure that whatever funds are available, that there are pipelines that can support them. And so if they're – and I'm going to defer to Key right about now because you're taking notes, and I don't want to mess up something that he's an expert on. But the money, I think, is out in the international community. And right now, if the pipelines aren't sufficient to support whatever supplies are coming through, it's not really going to matter how much money is in that pot. The real need is for pipelines to that are existing to be expanded and for new ones to be formed so aid can get out into the community. But I'm going to defer anything I may miss. I may have gotten wrong to Key.
But tomorrow's appeal is in front of the UN, correct?
It's actually going to be released today at 1:30. Through UN OCHA, they'll release the appeal. And I would say that, you know, our State Department colleagues are working all diplomatic channels, reaching out to other donors to receive pledges, and we are tracking this. That is something that we can make available. I think that's pretty public information. That said, you know, there was a rush when the International Federation of the Red Crescent released their appeal earlier in the week for about six million Swiss francs, and that was immediately fulfilled. So, again, I would echo what Patrick said here. There seems to be monies being made available. That said, we have to be very cautious looking at the UN appeal that's going to be released here. We want to make sure that we take a close look at it and be able to parse out what portion of it is for the emergency immediate needs, what portion of it is for more medium and long-term recovery, and what portion of it reflects the operational capacity of the partners who are requesting money to be able to ramp up activities quickly. So it's not a matter of X percentage of the appeal being met. Are the critical activities that are being proposed, do they match up with the realities at the field level? If so, this is something that we will look very closely at funding, and we would also be working with our other governmental donor colleagues to get those portions to be fully funded.
Walker Hardy from the National Defense University. Since there is such a problem getting teams in there, is there a greater need for satellite imagery? If so, are there any interagency efforts to get this and to publish it out and give it out to the NGOs that are there on the ground?
I mean, there is satellite imagery available. In fact, we have responded to a Burmese request for satellite imagery, commercial satellite imagery, for so that they could start to assess their needs. And I believe and Liz, correct me if I'm wrong, if we made that available to the UN, or if we did, we've made that available to the UN as well. So what we've had to share, we have shared.
Brad Hartfield, Century of Dialogue. There's another potential partner, set of partners that I haven't heard too much talk about that we're trying to develop partnerships with, namely some of the oil and gas industry that works in country that represent investors from investments from 10 or so countries. They have earth-moving equipment. They have helicopters. They, in my experience, they can expedite visas overnight. Do you know of work that's tried to form partnerships there? Also, do you have any... can you offer any support in getting that done? It's something we've been working on this week.
There has been outreach to the private sector. And for example, DHL has approached us in terms of offering up flights and planes to be able to bring in commodities. That is not something that we coordinate here at OFDA, but there is within the USC Agency for International Development that we have an office that GDA that is coordinating this. Again, I would ask you to contact them. I'm sure that there's been outreach, and they can give you more details in terms of what's being made available and how to contact and make outreach.
Certainly, I just say, as you probably know, Chevron is the largest U.S. company active in the country, and that is largely because when they acquired Unocal, they were grandfathered in before the new investment sanctions. So, they would be the, from the U.S. perspective anyway, the biggest private entity active there.
Okay, let me see if I can bundle a couple of questions, because two of our panelists in the NSC, or also the Office of Disaster Assistance, needs to get back. So if we have a couple of questions just for them, then we can let them go and continue our discussion. So, sir, and then madam.
Sean Garcia with Refugees International. I was just curious, because there's such a difficulty getting assessment teams in right now. To what extent are different governments and different people trying to bundle their assessment needs under the UN assessment team that probably has a better chance of going in? And to what extent are people trying to push just one assessment team like the UN getting in rather than flooding the government with requests for different teams?
Don Calabria. My question is an old one. Fred Cuny used to say that in a disaster, when stuff is available on the ground, we should send in cash and not people. And I just wondered if OFDA is looking at that.
Rina Mutia from the World Bank. My question is, I understand that the discussion still remained about access, but I'm wondering about the type of the humanitarian assistance given. WFP kept on giving biscuits. From my experience, my personal experience in Aceh after the tsunami, nobody ate the biscuits. And that's why basically a lot of people tried to sell the biscuits. I'm trying to reflect to the experience. So I'm wondering whether or not OFDA, for instance, like thinking about different type of humanitarian assistance given. For sure, people in Burma, they eat rice. Giving them biscuits, even though it's very... It has lots of nutritions and everything, but I don't think that it can help. Thank you.
Cesar Munoz with the FN News Service and International Newswire. What kind of leverage does the United States government have with Burma? Does it have any? I mean, is there something that, any kind of relationship that can be used in this situation? Thank you.
The first question regarding bundling assessments. We will take what we can get. You know, we initially were hoping to be able to come in with the UNDAC team. And then, as you've heard, the problems in terms of the UNDAC team, they initially were given permission for four members, and the four were sent in, and two of them were asked to go back. So it's not as if any of this is taking place in a robust manner. So the point being that if the UN would go in, we would use their information. Right now, the Interagency Standing Committee coordination that's taking place in Bangkok, everybody is sharing their information, and we're using that set of information to better inform funding decisions. So I think at this point, the coordination among donors is quite good, and the ability for operational partners like PACT and others to be able to feed in based upon what your colleagues are seeing at the field level are very welcomed, and we use every bit of information to better assess future funding levels. With regard to the question on cash is best, we agree. The only issue here is how do you get the money into the hands of the agencies and especially local entities in a way that the cash is not being diverted. That is being under discussions with our operational partners, vouchers, cash, anything that we can do that will provide the ability for beneficiaries and impacted people to be able to get access to food or clean water. We're looking at all options. And with regard to the humanitarian package, we are providing a set of activities here. Obviously, access to clean water is of the utmost concern. And part of what we're doing with the American Red Cross and what in terms has been released to units and others in terms of supporting water purification tablets, to bring in water purification units, plastic sheeting, blanket, jerry cans. So it's not just food that we're looking at here. Obviously, we're looking at the overall package.
And just to answer a good, very good question, I thought on what kind of leverage does the United States have? I think To take a different perspective of it is the leverage that we have is our track record for providing humanitarian assistance, whether it's through the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, the president's malaria initiative, whatever humanitarian initiatives that we've taken, and as well as all of the disasters that we continue to respond to around the world. That's our leverage, that we do this on a regular basis. We do in a variety of ways. And that's our leverage. We do this. We do it well. We work with the international community, and this is nothing new to us. It might be new to the Burmese to accept it from us, and we hope that they're open to that possibility. But I think the track record is our leverage in what we have done and what we'll continue to do around the world.
Well, I guess I would say I the only thing I would add is that in terms of the assistance package, I think you're also including bed nets, yeah,
yes.
And malaria, and these are two other diseases that really are an issue for this population. One is malaria. Most of the malaria in Burma is falciparum malaria, about 85% of it, which is the most severe form, and it also is a dengue area. It's been quite a bad dengue season this year in Southeast Asia. So you have people out in the open, many completely without shelters, sleeping next to open water in a zone with malaria and dengue. So I think bed nets, and if you can get them impregnated, bed nets are really probably a critical piece of the relief package.
Okay, we have to let our folks go from the U.S. government, and maybe we can stop there. We can have sort of comments offline and with media and others. It's unfortunate that Burma gets raised in consciousness, unfortunately, whenever there's a tragedy. Tragedy last fall. Tragedy now, it seems to be a star-crossed place. This is a long-term issue. We're not only just getting in is the beginning of the answer, and certainly not the full answer, because the needs are great. I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank our external affairs folks. We had to deal with some high-tech issues, and thank you for bearing that with us. Kate Hoffler, in particular, Steve Morrison, who really put this together on a moment's notice within a day to make sure this went off. He's the one behind it. He's with our Africa program. I want to thank him and his team for a spectacular job in putting this together, and for everyone else for coming out. Thank you very much on a Friday morning. So we'll adjourn here. Thank you.